This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
It's the evening edition. You're with Kelvin and Ayman. We continue with our wrap of the key events in 2019, and today our focus is on human rights. It's been more than a year since Pakatan Harapan won in GE14, and there continues to be a lot of attention on how we've been doing since then with regards to reforms in human rights.
So we'll be going through some of the key developments throughout the year with our guest, Shamini Darshni, who is the Executive Director of Amnesty International Malaysia, as well as Eric Paulson, Malaysia's representative to the ASEAN Intergovernmental Commission on Human Rights, or AICHA. So if you have any thoughts, you can WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. Eric, Shamini, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
So first of all, we've seen some developments this year in human rights, while other issues remain to be troubling, you can say that. What would be your assessment of how we've progressed in terms of human rights this year?
Well, I mean, there have been some positives, but there's also been quite a number of negatives. The negatives, of course, catch the eye of the public and the civil society organizations. So one of the more glaring examples have been the IPCMC, for example, the Independent Complaints Misconduct Commission, that has not passed in Parliament. So that's one. The other is the issue about SOSMA, the Security Offences Special Measures Act, that continuously has been used to arrest suspects and attempts to reform it has failed. Also, I think the third issue is quite important about death penalty. So the earlier promise was to fully abolish it, but now the compromise was that it won't longer be a mandatory nature. So it would be up to the judge to decide whether to impose the death penalty. So that's the negative.
And what about you, Shamini? What have been your assessments of human rights this year?
Similar to Eric, I think it's been a mixed bag of sorts. There's been both positive and negatives. In the course of the year, and I think especially in 2019, we felt the impact of what happened in 2018 as well, where human rights development are concerned. And some of the, I think, more glaring issues in terms of the maybe not so good stuff, of course, the government U-turning on the ratification of ICED in late 2018, that was still being talked about and debated on in 2019. And then we also saw the second U-turn when it came to an international instrument, which was the accession to the Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court. So these two things, I think these two items were quite glaring in terms of the negative developments where human rights were concerned. But there have been some positives, which is also good to be able to reflect upon. And I think one, we have not seen it come to pass yet, but hopefully it will be, is the 7-day paternity leave, which actually is a boost for gender equality in the workplace. And hopefully this proposal will come to pass. And while Eric had mentioned progress with the death penalty, and I think we can probably see that in two lights, because you have one part of it where yes, we are disappointed that the initial announcement of total abolition of the death penalty is now a step down from that total goal. And it's now the cabinet agreeing to abolish the mandatory death penalty. But in terms of as a development to that, we also saw the establishment of a task force that's looking at alternative sentencing to the mandatory death penalty. So I guess there has been some positive and negatives even within the different human rights themes. But one thing we have noted in 2018 and 2019, there has been perhaps a slightly larger space for civil society engagement with the government on these issues.
Sorry, I'd just like to add to what Shamini has said, because, you know, I think sometimes we forget how far we have come. Just 2 years ago, you know, we would know that quite a number of members of the government now, people in civil society, they were facing charges of sedition and Peaceful Assembly Act. So merely for, you know, protesting and voicing out against the wrongdoings in the country. And we know that 1MDB, the scandal, billions were siphoned off from the country, and the system has basically failed. From the law enforcement agencies, the MACC, to the judiciary, the police, and parliament wasn't a parliamentary place where there's no proper debate. So that has all changed in the last couple of years. But moving on to greater freedoms in Malaysia, I think it's worth noting that according to the RSF report, this Reporters Without Borders Press Freedom Index 2019, so Malaysia has jumped 22 places. You know, we are now 123 out of 180 countries in the world. Overall, it's still not great, but I think it's worth noting that within that 1 year, it was a great achievement for Malaysia. So Malaysia ranked the best in ASEAN for the moment.
And that's great, right? But, you know, just also going back briefly to the topic of death penalty, you know, we've seen just multiple developments throughout the year, and I guess just looking forward to next year, is that something you hope that we'll see positive developments with? Maybe starting with Shamini.
Absolutely. I mean, we've seen the government intending to put forward the bill to abolish the death penalty in totality in 2018 when the law minister made the announcement. And then subsequently, it became abolishing the mandatory death penalty. And those announcements about a bill to abolish the mandatory death penalty was also put forward in parliament. Now with the Task Force on Alternative Sentencing, we know that the Task Force is supposed to come up with a report in January 2020 on what alternative sentencing is going to look like. Amnesty has had consultations with the government on our views and perspectives and made some interventions on what alternative sentencing should encompass. Our suggestion, in a nutshell, really is to replace the mandatory death penalty with a term of imprisonment and without caning. We really do hope that, as was announced a few weeks ago, that the mandatory death penalty will be abolished in March 2020 without further delay.
And have you or Eric have had any conversations with inmates on death row? Like, I'm just wondering, what are their sentiments on the ground, and how have they been affected by these developments in terms of the in terms of the death penalty?
Not for me personally, but I do know that this alternative sentencing committee has met up with some of the inmates on death row. But I think the more important point, which I think we need to point out, is that why is there a consistent understanding that death penalty equates with deterrent of crime? Because there's no research in the world, scientific research, that states that, you know, if you have harsher punishment, therefore there will be lesser crimes. In fact, Malaysia's own research that's been done by the Attorney General's Chamber's office has you know, replicated the same result elsewhere in the world. So now the issue is to convince the public that the way forward is for better law enforcement, to strengthen the law enforcement agency, the police, so that they can apprehend criminals. So not to basically have harsh punishment for, you know, drug offences, for example, because as we know, for drug offences, we are talking about small amount of drugs, and these are drug mules who have been either tricked or pressured, or for a small amount of money decided to that it's a good idea to possess drugs. So here we're talking about a small amount. So for heroin or morphine, we're talking about 15 grams of drugs and you can be hanged. Cannabis is 300 grams, which is just a handful. So I think it's quite disproportionate to the punishment. And international law is clear. Death penalty, yes, technically it can be imposed, but it's for the most serious offence. And that has been interpreted to be intentional murder, not for drugs.
So, you know, just with that, right, and I guess some of the back steps we've seen, particularly with this, it does seem as if there is this huge desire and huge desire from the end of the government to actually move a lot faster. But there is a lot of public engagement that they have to do. You know, as you've said, Eric, there is the understanding that, well, the death penalty always acts as a deterrent, but it doesn't show that it's the case. So, you know, all that aside, right, how can actually the government move a lot quicker on this, seeing that, you know, if they have a firm stance, for example, we've seen the health ministry actively saying that, look, drug addiction is not a crime. Drug addiction is a health problem. We should treat them like patients. But on the other end, it's harder when it comes to the death penalty, because you are also seeing that, you know, can the government actually, if they wanted to, could this just steamroll through this whole thing without engaging with the public directly?
Well, it is possible for a very strong government to steamroll reforms, but I don't think that is the right way. You know, in a democratic nation, you should engage with all stakeholders, including members of the public, civil society organizations, but also importantly, we are talking about the state agencies and also with parliamentarians. So there must be a process to conduct major reforms. But nonetheless, having said that, political will is important. But also, I think we need to understand that you know, sometimes it's easier to leave things be. People don't like changes. And some of these reforms that have been proposed are quite major changes. And that is why sometimes it is not moving as quickly as we hope to see.
I think it also is worth remembering that the debate on whether or not to abolish the death penalty in Malaysia is not a new one. It was first announced in 2007 by a previous law minister, Nasri Aziz. So it has been going on for a while. There's been, as Eric mentioned, there's been a study, there's been two studies actually on whether or not the death penalty in its mandatory form should be abolished in Malaysia. And from what we understand, the cabinet has made a decision to abolish the mandatory death penalty. So that seems like, you know, a concerted effort by the cabinet to make a decision that is unpopular because they know it's the right thing to do. And that is something that we, of course, would support. But we also have to remember that abolishing the mandatory death penalty is only a first step towards total abolition. So while we are encouraging the government to abolish the mandatory death penalty, it doesn't end there. Mm. Yeah. And you also asked a question about families and family engagement and what do we know about prisoners on death row and how they are responding to the death penalty debate right now. In our work on abolition, Amnesty has engaged with families of death row inmates, particularly those in Malaysia, but to a certain extent, Malaysian families who have loved ones on death row in Singapore. And we know that at least death row inmates in Malaysia, from the families that we've spoken to, they are very relieved that there is a moratorium on executions, so that we know, which means that they are not going to be hanged. In the same breath, we are also encouraging the Malaysian government to keep the moratorium in place until, you know, the death penalty is abolished. But we also have concerns around what landed people on death row in the first place. And these are issues with investigations, the quality of investigations. There's been allegations of torture and ill treatment in police custody of suspects arrested for capital crimes. Those issues are not actually addressed with the abolition of the death penalty.
So there are underlying issues behind it as well.
Correct. Mm. And these need, you know, I'm not a legal professional, but as a layperson, what it looks to me is there is a need for a reform of the criminal justice system, from investigations to the legal representation and quality of legal representation. There are fair trial concerns. All of this has actually been documented in a report that Amnesty published this year called Fatally Flawed, where we looked at who is exactly on death row and all the challenges that come from the start of an investigation to the end of the process of a person being on death row. So yeah, you're right. Underlying issues.
We're speaking today to Eric Paulson of Aichir and Shamin Darshini of Amnesty International Malaysia. More after this on the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9.
Be firmly motivated. BFM 89.9.
It's the evening edition with Kelvin and Ayman, and we continue our wrap-up of the theme of human rights this year together with Eric Paulson, representative of Malaysia to ICHR, and Sharmini Darshini, executive director at Amnesty International Malaysia. So just briefly, just wrapping up this conversation we've been having essentially on the death penalty, looking to our neighbours, Singapore, we saw drug mules handed the death sentence there. It feels almost helpless when Malaysians who become drug mules are given that sentence there. The government's tried numerous ways, you know, through diplomatic channels, through maybe even, I guess, unofficial channels. Is there anything that can be done in this dire situation?
Well, I mean, as far as the some of the family members that Lawyers for Liberty do represent in my former organization, so we have supported the families in terms of assisting in for legal representation by lawyers in Singapore. But I think in terms of legal representation, it's quite limited because at the end of the day, you are stacked up against a system that is very it is one-sided in the sense that the laws are very harsh. And whether or not one of the more contentious provision in the Singapore's law is that whether or not you'll be given the death penalty depends on the level of cooperation that the accused has given to the authority. So in terms of giving information to arrest further person. But how this process happened is very opaque. Some convicts have said that, look, I've assisted the Singapore authorities as much as I could with all information that I have. But nonetheless, this certificate of cooperation was not given. And then some other person has been given. So what happens, the public prosecutor in Singapore essentially plays a dual role, not only as prosecutor, but also decides whether the person that he or she is prosecuting deserves to be hanged or not.
Let's talk about some controversial laws that still continue to exist in 2019. So recently we saw SOSMA being used to detain 12 individuals allegedly involved with the LTTE group. What were your reflections on the maintenance of these laws this year in 2019?
First of all, it is quite disappointing. That the security laws such as SOSMA, POCA, Prevention of Crime Act, and POTA, Prevention of Terrorism Act, have been retained in 2019. But we do understand that there are challenges in how to reconcile the need for tough laws and how to handle suspected terrorist threats. That being said, these laws include a provision for detention without trial. So that is not something that is human rights compliant, because everyone, regardless of the nature of the crime that they are suspected of having committed, has a right to legal counsel, has a right for his or her day in court. Now, the detention without trial provision has also shown to have been abused, where we've had, we know of stories from detainees about being subjected to torture and ill treatment while they are being held in custody without the scrutiny of lawyers or the courts. So what we're saying about what Amnesty is suggesting, at least for security laws and these types of provisions like detention without trial, is that such laws need to be reviewed periodically to ensure that they actually comply with international standards, that regular assessment of such laws and how they are being used is needed to be conducted by independent body to be able to scrutinize these laws to ensure application is fair. What we know from these laws, especially where detention without trial is concerned, is that it is not human rights compliant and it's been abused.
I'd just like to clarify a bit with what Sharmini has said. There is detention without trial, but that is for Prevention of Crime Act, POCA, and POTA, Prevention of Terrorism Act. SOSMA, there's actually a trial, but the trial is not in compliance with international standards. So what happened in SOSMA is a procedural provision whereby for certain offences in the penal code that is termed to be security offences, they have a special procedure whereby the normal criminal procedures and standard of evidence are relaxed. So evidence that is normally not admissible in a normal criminal trial, for example, murder trial, is admissible in a SOSMA trial. So essentially what you have is a trial whereby the standards of fair trial is extremely poor, and therefore the likelihood of conviction is very high. So evidence that is obtained by torture, for example, is admissible. So therefore it's very questionable.
Chamini, when you said challenges in abolishing these laws, could you expand on that point?
Sure. I think in a lot of countries where governments have to deal with the threat of terrorism or introduce counterterrorism measures, it is difficult to address them from a purely security perspective, because what governments don't explore are the root causes of terrorism. And that includes issues like poverty, for example.
And at the same time, the Anti-Fake News Act was abolished, while the Peaceful Assembly Act was amended to shorten the number of days that demonstrators have to inform authorities. Why were these achievable while, you know, the other ones like SOSMA, POTA, POCA, Sedition Act, National Security Council Act, they were more difficult in terms of seeing progress? What are these sort of like reasons behind that?
For the Anti-Fake News Act, I think it's more of it's quite a partisan issue because the now opposition decided to just oppose it for no good reason. Because this Anti-Fake News Act, if you were to read the provision, it is essentially not workable. But nonetheless, it has been abolished. So when it comes to much more contentious, but in the eyes of the law enforcement agency, especially the Home Ministry, they feel that such laws are needed on SOSMA, for example, because it deals with national security and what they say that this is needed in order for them to combat terrorism, for example. So, you know, if you're a law enforcement agency who are used to work the way they normally do, with a lot of powers, with little check and balances. So obviously, if you know people were to want to curtail their powers, so it's only natural that they were to resist. But I think we should be able to ask the question back to the authorities and especially the Home Ministry. How is it that other countries are able to tackle issues of national security, issues of terrorism, without resorting to such measures? You know, terrorism, whether it happened in the UK or in Belgium or in France or Australia, is similar to Malaysia. And there's no reason why Malaysia cannot raise its standard of anti-terrorism laws, laws that can arrest, search, detain and punish alleged terrorists at the same level as with some of these countries.
We're speaking today to Eric Paulson, representative of Malaysia to ICHR, as well as Chamini Darshini, executive director at Amnesty International Malaysia. We will continue our conversation after the 6:30 news. You are listening to BFM 89.9.
Bole for Malaysia. Ha. BFM 89.9. The Business Station.
You're listening to the Evening Edition with Kelvin and Ayman, and today we're doing a wrap-up of human rights in 2019, and joining us to do that today is Eric Paulson, representative of Malaysia at ICHR, and Chamini Darshini, executive director at Amnesty International Malaysia. So this year also saw a couple of headlines relating to Indigenous rights. There was the Kuala Koa crisis that saw 15 deaths attributed to measles. And in terms of land rights, there was the tussle between the Perak state government and the villages at Kampung Tasik Kunex, while Putrajaya took Kelantan to court over land issues. How has the state of Indigenous rights fared in 2019?
Well, sadly, the situation is still the same. I'm afraid Malaysia Baru has not reached the Orang Asli. They remain one of the most marginalised communities in Malaysia. So as you have said, some of these shocking headlines, we don't expect to see Malaysia Baru in terms of their land has been taken, deaths caused by measles. And there's also issue about unwanted conversion and also unwanted bird control. So I think what is really needed is actually political will from the government. Yes, I understand that some of these issues regarding land rights, it might fall within the purview of individual states. But nonetheless, I think the federal government must take a lead in terms of recognizing the land rights of the Orang Asli. And we don't have to go far, but we just need to implement Suakam's report on the National Inquiry into the Land Rights of Indigenous People in 2013, which have made some very good recommendations, including establishing a special land tribunal to give effective recognition to their rights.
Absolutely. The Kelantan state government, the federal government, sorry, the AG, taking Kelantan state government to court, specifically on the land issue in Kuala Musang, was really a good step in the right direction. But, you know, and I think subsequently in Kota Baru High Court, the Kelantan government tried to strike out the suit and it failed. That is good. Although there has been no updates since then, we are hoping that, you know, this case will continue to proceed.
What would the good next steps be when it comes to cases like this, particularly with land rights and indigenous people?
Well, there has to be greater recognition that these are the original people of the land, that this land traditionally belonged to them. So one of the ways forward is to set up a national commission to recognize their land and to gazette this land, that this land actually essentially belonged to them. Land, of course, is a very precious commodity, and that is why you know these lands are given to companies in order for them to explore, to mine, you know, to build plantation, etc., etc. But these efforts are short-sighted, because at the end of the day, these orang asli have human rights like all of us. In fact, they have greater rights because some of these rights are specific to them.
If I may add, in late 2018, Amnesty published a report that looked at land grabbing in six states in Malaysia. The report is called "The Forest is Our Heartbeat." And the report looked at land grabbing in the six states, which included Kelantan. And one of the common themes that had that was running through land issues, indigenous land issues, is the threat and intimidation of indigenous human rights defenders. And those threats are coming from government or possibly business entities. And that is one thing that we are also concerned about, is the threats and intimidation towards indigenous land right defenders, which really needs to stop.
Sorry, I just like to add that, having said that, one of the most important things when it comes to making policies regarding the orang asli is that they should be consulted, because all these policies that affect their lives, whether in terms of education, in terms of healthcare, etc., who knows better than the orang asli themselves? So a greater effort must be made to ensure that there's more orang asli staff when it comes to dealing with them. And in this regard, the government has actually taken a very positive role by appointing Professor Julie Edo. He's an orang asli himself, so he's a former professor of anthropology at University of Malaya. So now he's the head of the Jabatan Kemajuan Orang Asli Jakoa.
But, I just wonder if that might be enough, right? You perhaps have just one person at the top trying to bring changes down to an institution that for a while has been seen as not essentially working for the community that they're planning to, that they were supposed to serve. You know, is then the next step to hire perhaps more orang asli community members into Jakoa specifically, and also actually to other governmental agencies?
I certainly hope so, so that this issue about, misunderstanding, as the authorities claim, regarding, issues regarding their health, for example, or regarding when they apply for their MyCards. So, regarding their names, because there have been allegations that just because they have a Malay or Muslim-sounding name, there have been allegations that, Islam has been added to their documentation. So if there are a greater number of orang asli working within their community, in government agencies dealing with them, then I hope such problems can be avoided in the future.
So just to continue on this conversation about minority rights, in terms of the LGBT community, we saw there were like five men caned and jailed this year for what the media report said was for attempting gay sex. So has anything changed when it comes to LGBT rights here in Malaysia?
I think that this is not so good news. I really think that there has been increased intimidation against the LGBTI community in the past 1 year plus. started late last year with the caning of the two women who were attempting to have sex, and then again with a group of men this year who, you know, who were found guilty for having sex against the order of nature. And I think that some of the conversations and the narratives and debates that is happening publicly is actually quite toxic towards safeguarding the rights of the LGBTI community. It's quite a bad state.
Yeah, I would have to concur because we have seen over the last couple of years, the LGBT community, they have become like a punching bag. So they've been blamed for a lot of things which is not connected to them. And I just like to caution that there's a lot of hate that has been unnecessarily, thrown around. And I think hate can lead to hate crimes. And there is a report that states that from 2001 to 2019, 19 transgender people have been killed. And 9 of those were killed in the last 2 years.
I guess this is a little bit surprising to, well, not necessarily surprising, but the stance change has been a bit shocking to me, because last year there was a seeming openness to engage at least with the LGBT community, but this year that doesn't seem to have happened as much. Why do you think that has been this step back, right? Is the government perhaps just responding to what the public wants, or perhaps what more vocal members of the public desire when it comes to treatment of the LGBTQ community?
We're teetering on political analysis here, but I think because the Pakatan Harapan government came into power based on many different issues and platforms, but one of the things that they PH kept touting before the elections was about equality. And it's not just, you know, doing away with the race narrative, doing away with the religious narrative. And as Eric mentioned just now, the LGBTI community seems to have been scapegoated. And honestly, in my opinion, and I think that is absolutely true, because with this government, the narrative of race and religion might be a little bit tougher, because that is the platform that they want on. And it's not a secret. It's a strategy of, unfortunately, too many governments of scapegoating or blaming minorities, including LGBTI or refugees, asylum seekers, you know, blaming minority groups for the problems of the country. And this is, unfortunately, an example of that.
We're speaking today to Eric Paulson, representative of Malaysia at ICHR, as well as Shamini Darshini, executive director at Amnesty International Malaysia. After this, we will continue our conversation, particularly touching on the Suakan report as well as child rights. This is the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9.
Bigotry Free Malaysia, BFM 89.9.
It's Kelvin and Ayman on the Evening Edition, and in the studio with us is Eric Paulson of ICHR, as well as Shamini Darshini of Amnesty International Malaysia. They're here to help us look into the human rights news of 2019. Now, moving on to child rights, there were a couple of developments. 7 states have refused to ban child marriage. The Home Minister also announced earlier that there were no plans to ban unilateral conversion. And there were also some conversations about children in immigration detention. From your point of view, perhaps starting with Eric, how have you seen the conversation on child rights move forward in 2019?
Well, there has been a positive in the midst of quite a number of negatives. There is a child rights commissioner now that has been appointed within Suhakam. So now there is greater recognition that there should be a specific commissioner to tackle child rights issues. But having said that, the issue of child marriages is still a problem. But I'd like to add that it doesn't just affect the Muslim community. It also affects the non-Muslim community. Regarding the issue that only 7 states have refused to outlaw child marriage, it is a difficult issue, because, you know, various state, they have their own laws on Islamic issues. But I think this can be resolved if the federal government were to outlaw child marriage as a whole. But it's easier said than done, because obviously you can't bulldoze through such issues. There must be a lot of consultation with all the stakeholders, and especially with all the states, and especially with the Islamic authorities.
And in terms of check and balance, right, this year we saw Parliament debate Suakam's annual report for the first time since Suakam was established 19 years ago. How did you see the significance of this event?
It was, definitely a hallmark decision to have the Suakam report tabled and debated on in Parliament. I think it was also an indication of the government's commitment to foster more conversation and debate in Parliament about human rights issues. A specific space was given, so that was good. But I also think that what came out of the debate was also a bit worrying, because we saw debates around or conversations around how ICERD was contrary to Article 153 of the Federal Constitution, which constitutional experts and academics and lawyers have already said that it doesn't. In fact, it's complementary. We also saw, again, the narrative of race and religion and the continued demonizing of the LGBTI community also happen in the same vein. So while it was good that it was tabled, the report was tabled, we also saw misconceptions come out about what human rights actually is. Pro and con.
Eric?
It just goes to show that the quality of our representation in parliament is not very high. Sometimes Malaysians don't have a control in terms of who they vote in parliament, because the choices are quite lacking. But having said that, at the end of the day, whatever they say in parliament, this is all reported in the Hansard, it's widely reported in the press. Their opinions and the level of the debate, I hope they should reflect. What they've said, because at the end of the day, they are supposed to be members of parliament to represent their constituency. They're supposed to represent what is right and wrong in the country. If you have a bad argument, then they should be called out. And I think in Malaysia Baru, that is the case.
Now, just continuing on this theme of check and balance, parliament recently delayed the reading of the IPCMC bill, which sets out to serve as a check and balance to the police. Law Minister VK Liu said that this was to further improve the bill. Amnesty International had come out earlier to say that the initial bill was lacking in some elements. What are those elements?
So we've been a part of some of the consultations that the government has called for on the IPCMC bill. And in the one of the later versions that we had seen, we saw a couple of drawbacks to the bill. And the first, where there was no procedure for appointing or dismissing commissioners, but commissioners could be appointed or dismissed solely at the discretion of the Prime Minister or the Agong, And this, in turn, jeopardizes the independence of the commission, making it more prone to political interference or pressure. And where this is concerned, our recommendation was that the IPCMC Act, when it comes into force, should lay out a clear appointment procedure for commissioners. Another aspect of the bill that we were quite concerned with was that compared to the existing Enforcement Agency Integrity Commission, the IPCMC bill seemed to focus more on disciplinary misconduct and criminal offences. And the recommendation on this was the IPCMC should be better empowered to really address issues that were that are really serious, such as that's in police custody, police shooting, and the like. It needed the IPCMC needs to have more bite compared to the mechanisms that we have now, which is the EAIC.
I have to disagree with Shamini okay. on this point. Regarding the IPCMC bill, yes, it's not a perfect bill. But I think if you're looking for a perfect bill, That would never come. The bill in itself, I thought it was quite strong. There are provisions whereby it's independent, I would think so. And then there are procedures whereby they can initiate investigations on their own. I think more importantly, they have provisions whereby they can actually impose punishment, this which is actually quite unusual. In most other jurisdictions, they only can recommend punishment. And I think there's also another provision there that is quite strong. If there's a death in custody or grievance that is caused while the person is under the custody of the police, there's an automatic investigation. I would like also like to just maybe draw a bit of comparison with Suhakam. Suhakam is 20 years old. Suhakam, when he was first initiated, and Suhakam now is between night and day. I think there must be a process to allow structures and processes to happen. It cannot happen overnight. Suhakam, when he was first initiated, there was a similar outcry that this would be a tool by the government. It's going to be used to cover up human rights issues in Malaysia. But I think the key is, over the last 15 years or so, there have been very good appointments by people who are interested in human rights, who are actually committed to the issue, have been appointed. And I think the process can happen in IPSMC. So key would be appointing the right people to these positions, and hopefully with the commitment and the resources given to the IPSMC, then we are able to have a strong and independent IPSMC that we deserve. But I take Shamini's point regarding that there should be greater checks and balance when it comes to whether such commissioners can be appointed or to be dismissed.
So we've been talking a lot about human rights in Malaysia so far, but I just want to ask the both of you, perhaps starting with you first, Eric, what have been the standout developments in terms of regional or international human rights?
For me, it has to be the Rohingya crisis, because although this has been going on for the past decade or so, or even longer, recently, as you know, Myanmar was taken to the International Criminal Court by Gambia. And of course, it is for the whole world to see, whereby the Myanmar government and especially Aung San Suu Kyi was forced to listen to all these submissions regarding the atrocity of that has been committed, including genocide. So I think countries in the region and especially ASEAN can no longer take a backseat by saying that this particular issue is an internal matter for respective countries to resolve, because clearly issues of genocide, atrocity, crimes against humanities, these are not minor issues. These are the most serious crimes imaginable, and it's a concern for all of us. In addition, there's at least 150,000 Rohingyas in Malaysia, which goes to show that crimes of such magnitude have repercussion in the region and also worldwide.
And I guess just moving towards 2020, how far have we come over the past decade in terms of human rights?
I think some of the issues that we have been discussing today, particularly, death penalty and whether or not it should be abolished, whether or not we need to have an independent police commission and what that should look like. These are old issues. Enlarging the space for freedom of expression through relaxing some of the laws that we have or abolishing some of them, Sedition Act, Peaceful Assembly Act, that kind of thing. These are issues that we have talked about for 10 years and more. It's not new issues, and hopefully when we move into the new year, we will actually see some concrete changes in establishing mechanisms to protect the public and also to enlarge that spaces for people to exercise their freedoms better.
Eric?
For me, I hope the good changes regarding the institutions of the police, the Attorney General's Chambers, the judiciary, the MACC would be carried on, because I don't know what we want for institutions to be freed up, so that it doesn't matter which government is in power. As long as these law enforcement agencies are independent, they are strong enough, then they are able to carry on investigations, prosecution, and to adjudicate in a fair, transparent and fair manner. So, and I think that only can bode well for Malaysia in the coming future.
We've been speaking today to Eric Paulson, representative of Malaysia to AICHR, as well as Shamini Darshini, executive director at Amnesty International Malaysia. You've been listening to the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my. BFM 89.9, the business station.